Jesus has just performed one miracle, but there are people who follow him because of all of the miracles that they are hoping for. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here's a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves. Am I not switching? Sorry about this. That's good now. Okay. All right. One more down. Okay. Jesus then took the loaves. We'll get it. We'll catch up. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He also did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Okay, feeding an army has always been a major problem in warfare. Even the best training, weapons, and strategy will not win wars if the soldiers are not well fed. And so they have to have the strength to fight. They have to have supplies to last as long as the war might last. So this miracle, along with the others that had brought them there in the first place, convinced this crowd that Jesus was the leader that they were looking for. And they decided to make him their king. So here was a king whose army would never starve to death, or whose people couldn't be surrounded and starved until they surrendered, as in siege warfare. Here was a king who could heal injured and sick soldiers. Most importantly, all of this meant that here was a king who had God on his side. But Jesus wouldn't accept their offer of allegiance. Why? In fact, he withdrew into the hills, and since it says that they were planning to force this on him, he may have had to actually run to escape. But in any case, he ended up alone. Well, his disciples were probably as confused as anyone by this. And when I was a kid, I was confused by this. I thought, why? What's the deal here? Jesus was supposed to be king. They wanted to make him king. Why didn't he let them make him king? Well, the problem was they didn't want a king. They wanted a genie. Okay, they wanted a genie to give them whatever they wanted. And so likely his disciples were just as confused and disappointed as everybody else. And they got into a boat to go back to the other side of the lake, to Capernaum, which was their home base. So read with me starting at verse 16. We'll switch them when we're supposed to do this thing. Okay. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water. And they were terrified. But he said to them, "It's me. Don't be afraid. Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. All right, what is going on here? Well, it was too windy to use their sails, so they had gotten into the boat, and they were having to row against the wind, apparently, and they were making progress. They had rowed about 3.5 miles. That's pretty hard rowing. And then Jesus comes walking toward them. Well, at first they don't know it's him and they're scared to death. But then he identifies himself and they take him into the boat, and then all of a sudden they reach their destination. Well, what is going on? What can we learn from all of this? Well, within these two events, we can see the reason that God doesn't seem to us to be dealing with our problems. The two events I've talked about are the feeding of the 5,000 and Jesus walking to them on the water. Once we see the reason that God doesn't seem to be dealing with our problems, we will be open to understanding what our real problem is. The apostles thought that they needed a military leader to set them free. They thought that Roman oppression was their problem. But that was not their real problem. So the big problem in the lesson, the big picture in the lesson is this, and that is that we must submit to God's priorities. The truth was they needed a shepherd rather than a king. As they envisioned a king and his purposes, at least, they needed a shepherd rather than that kind of a king. And that is our greatest need as well. We will never be happy or content until we accept God as he is. We cannot make him into what we want him to be. We cannot use God for our purposes to accomplish our priorities. At the same time, we will never be free of anxiety and fear until we learn that this does not mean that God is not a self-serving tyrant. He's not out to use us until we're no longer useful or until we mess up somehow and then throw us away. We have to grasp and remember that God does not care to please us, but he does care for us. Well, how can that be? If God cares for us, why doesn't he care to please us? Well, as our shepherd, he knows our needs. And first of all, we need to be fed. So first, let's think about what happened when he fed those 5,000 men. They were pleased by that. In fact, that pleased them so much that they decided that he should be their king. But just because they were pleased by what Jesus did does not mean, or did not mean, that he did it to please them. The kids came in. So they're back there if you want to take them to their class. Okay. So they found that out when he would not let them make him their king. So he didn't do this just to get them on his side. Jesus wasn't buying their loyalty with an amazing fish dinner. He was simply caring for some people in a way that revealed who he was. So wasn't there something wrong with their ideas about kingship here anyway? I mean, they're going to make him be their king. There's a way that you make someone king, but it's not by making them do what you want them to do. You make someone king by making yourself subject to him. And, you know, not by making him subject to you. You're the slave. He's the master. So their problem was they didn't want a king, they wanted a genie, they wanted someone with the power to make all of their wishes come true. So, you know, three guys shipwrecked, wash ashore on a deserted island, find a bottle, they clean it, and out pops this genie. And so the genie says, you have three wishes. So the three guys decide to divide the wish, each one gets one wish. So the first guy says, that's easy, I wish I were back home. Oof. And the second guy says, well, me too. I wish I were back home. Poof. And then the third guy wasn't so smart. He was very indecisive. And he says, boy, I wish I had my friends here to help me decide what to do. Poof. So, you know, actually, most of the time we get into trouble when we think we do know exactly what we want, don't we? What would have happened if Jesus had granted those 5,000 men their wish? What if he had fed them and led them to drive out the Romans? And then he had set up a kingdom in Jerusalem. That would have pleased them very much. But it would have left them without hope in the end. And it would have been a paragraph in our history books at best. Might not have even been made the history books. It would have just been this small little kingdom off in this insignificant part of the world. Well, what are you wanting right now? What could God do that would please you? You know, is it a new car, a new job, a new house, freedom from all your debts, maybe that person that is missing in your life? Maybe you'd prefer to be living somewhere else or to be part of a different church. Maybe you're wanting power or prestige, or you're wanting things to be done in a way that you think would be better, maybe in our country. Maybe there's someone you think you'd be better off without them in your life. Could God give any of those things to us? Sure he could. He could do it, and he might do it, but we just better be glad he doesn't do those kinds of things just because we want him to. Most of the time, we'd end up blowing our opportunity to really see permanent progress. We don't want long-term solution. Can you imagine saying, I wish God would teach me to be patient as I work through my problems over the next 10 years? You know, nobody thinks like that. We're so prone to look for the quick fix that we'd never wish for a long-term solution if it were left completely up to us. And that's why God doesn't operate that way. He does allow us the basic freedom to choose between trusting in him or trusting in ourselves. But thankfully, he doesn't just do whatever we tell him to do. It's not that he wants to deprive us or to show us who's boss even. It's not that he doesn't care about us. In fact, the reason God doesn't give us everything we want is because he does care about us. What we need to focus on is real needs, and God represents our basic needs. God does not care to please us, but he does care for us. So what are our real needs? Well, as our shepherd, he knows our needs. First of all, we need to be fed. I got these in the wrong order. How do you think the disciples might have felt while they were out there rolling in the wind and the waves? Well, it had been a confusing day. Up to this point, they had thought that this was just the opportunity that Jesus would be looking for. And before he fed the crowd, some of them might have questioned whether or not they were prepared to take on the Roman army, but then he feeds 5,000 men with 5 loaves of bread and 2 small fish. So then they were convinced that anything was possible. The crowd was enthusiastic. But then when the crowd is making its move to make Jesus king, he takes off. Now, here the disciples are out in the middle of the lake in a terrible storm, rowing for their lives, and where is Jesus? Well, their Messiah, their deliverer, their Savior, isn't anywhere near them that they know of. So they might have even wondered whether it was all over. Had Jesus maybe gotten cold feet now that he had faced the prospect of really having to fight with them against the Romans? And he was just going to leave them completely. Well, then when they see what looks like a man walking on the water, you know, it's nighttime. It doesn't even occur to them, for some reason, that it's Jesus coming to them. They're not comforted by this at all. In fact, they're scared to death. Then he says, it's me. Don't be afraid. And so when they take him into the boat, it immediately reaches the shore where they were going. What was Jesus trying to teach them by doing this in this way? He didn't have to do it this way. You know, he could have saved them all of that rowing by miraculously transporting all of them back home in the first place. Or he could have just let them row onto the shore and then met them there. So the lesson I see in this incident is this, and that is that Jesus, just because we can't see what Jesus is doing or we don't understand what he's doing, doesn't mean that he's doing nothing. See, most importantly for them, Jesus hadn't chickened out. He hadn't given up. He hadn't left them to save his own skin. He was watching out for them, but in his own way and on his own time schedule. And that's important for us. We don't need miraculous transport through the maze. We need leadership. We need the way out. And our problem is no different from theirs. We might think that we'd have more faith if we could just see one of those amazing miracles. If we could see one of those, we'd really believe in prayer, and so we'd pray more faithfully. We'd look to him for all of our needs. Well, Jesus' disciples may not have been the most highly educated people around, but they weren't dumb. They were probably more intelligent than most of us, maybe all of us. Yet they continued to question Jesus, to doubt him, to be confused. They weren't always sure that he could or would take care of them. So now, as John writes, maybe 50 years later, he was one of them. John is writing to the next generation of Jesus followers to encourage them to be faithful. He says, your problem isn't that you weren't eyewitnesses like I was to Jesus' miracle, or that you didn't hear his teachings firsthand, you know, to be sure that they were authentic. Your problem is the same as the problems of us, the eyewitnesses. Your problem is that you're too easily shaken because you think that you know how it's all supposed to happen, and because his ways seem strange to you. But John is saying, hang in there. Just when you think it's all over, he'll show you that he was there with you all along. He won't let you be destroyed by the elements. This is the message of John's gospel. Now, isn't that a comforting message? We might still think we prefer a cloud over us by day and a pillar of fire by night and manna on the ground every morning like the Israelites got, but can't we trust him to know what is best for us? If we need a lightning bolt from the sky, he can do that. He's God. But if he prefers to speak in a still, small voice, why would we refuse to listen? If he wants it to seem as if he were letting nature take its course, or even if he really is letting nature take its course, that doesn't mean that he's not watching and listening. He won't let us be destroyed. We have nothing to fear. These days in America, our lives are not often threatened by the elements, even when there are major storms or fires. Some do certainly suffer loss and even death, but you know, for example, 25 or so deaths when 20,000 homes burn is a pretty low number compared to thousands of deaths that some suffer in a tsunami in other parts of the world, and the millions who have died due to pandemics in past generations. So we're really pretty well protected from the wind and the waves most of the time. But many of the things that do threaten us are a part of the same earthly system. You know, there's disease and injury and pollution and nuclear warfare and the economy. And the threats to our self-respect and inner security are mostly threats from the physical world rather than the spiritual. But there are spiritual forces that are threatening to us as well. And God is even more concerned to protect us from those being destroyed by Satan. The bottom line is, he'll be there when we need him, and he'll let us struggle with our problems for as long as we need to, but no longer. He lets us suffer because we need to suffer, but he doesn't let us suffer any longer than we need to suffer. And it's not because he doesn't care, it's because he does care. Maybe you were accused by your kids of being mean and just looking for ways to catch them so that you can punish them. But you know better than that. You know how hard it is to punish your kids, don't you? And you're looking for ways to lighten their punishment. You know, I was pretty bad about that. I would, you know, not stick by my guns as I should have and carry out the whole sentence, you know, because, you know, you really need to do that because you love them. And the reason that you punish them is not because you don't love them. It's only because you really believe that they'd suffer more in the long run if you let them off, right? So you know that they'll have responsibilities that won't quit. They'll have a boss, they'll have a husband, a wife, a church family, and you know that they need to learn to avoid the punishment by avoiding the behavior. Because they will be punished, one way or another. So don't you think that God feels the same way when we suffer? Don't you think that he jumps at the chance to legitimately knock off a few days of the suffering? Don't you think that the only reason that he lets it go on is because there's something in it that we need? So God will feed us, but there are problems with what we want in our feeding. The answer to all of our problems is not going to be found in getting God on our side. He's on our side, but if we want him to be our king, then all we have to do is become his subject and submit to his rule, to his plan. If you don't like the way he does things, that's not so unusual. Men have always been limited in their vision, and God won't give up on you just because you're confused or you're disappointed. But if you don't step back later on and look at what God has done, you know, in retrospect, you may never grow in your trust in God. And this is what the lesson about the spiral of faith reminded us a couple of weeks ago. If you don't remember what God has done once you figure it out, then you may give up on God. So let me give you just one example that relates to the church as a whole. You know, one of the things that most of us are concerned about is the rate of growth or the non-rate of growth in the size of our number, of our membership. You know, that's something that churches always are worried about unless they're growing like crazy and then they, you know, feel good about that. Well, actually, we shouldn't be concerned about numbers as such. We should be concerned that we have friends and neighbors who are lost. And they don't seem to be getting any closer to finding their way. Yes, they will need a church family to help them either, you know, either to get there or to help them stay with God once they, you know, get to where they need to be. But our purpose is not to grow the church. Our purpose is to love and serve the lost, no matter how it ends up affecting our church. So consider this. Why did Jesus reject 5,000 disciples and just go on with the 12? Was it because he didn't care about the 5,000? Was it because there was no hope for the 5,000? No, it was because he knew that some things had to happen before those 5,000 and the many millions like them could gain the victory and the peace that would come with it. You've heard of God in a box, and that's when we want God to limit God, you know, to parts of our lives and limit him to certain kinds of actions. Well, sometimes we want God in a bottle. We just need to remember that he's not our genie. He's our God. He doesn't care to please us, but he does care for us. So he will feed us. But the problem is that we want candy, and we need broccoli, right? And then he will lead us, but the problem is that we want prestige, but we need humility and patience. He cares about your hurts, he cares about your soul, he knows what kind of therapies, though, that you really need. So he's not our genie. He is our God.